Today's program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit TabardInn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. We're going to talk today about a medical additive to the livestock industry called ractopamine. There's actually a whole class of them. They're called beta agonists. And on the phone with me today is Guy Lonergan, a veterinary epidemiologist and professor of food safety and public health at Texas Tech University. Dr. Lonergan's research mission is to improve animal and public health by identification and exploration of solutions that address society's challenges. Oh, boy, that's a tall order, Doc. He is a member of the National Advisory Committee on Microbiological Criteria for Foods, the International Association of Food Protection, Academy of Veterinary Consultants, for which he serves on the board of directors, the Conference of Research Workers in Animal Diseases, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, my favorite, and the Texas and Southwest Cattle Raisers Association, Texas Cattle Feeders Association, and the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. In other words, this is the man. If you want to know about cattle production, Dr. Guy Lonergan is the guy to ask. So, hello, Guy.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I hope you enjoyed that introduction. I know I did. I can't believe I got through it without actually stumbling over some of those words. And I didn't practice. So, Guy, you and several partners at Texas Tech recently published a paper. It was called The Increased Mortality in Groups of Cattle Administered Adrenergic agonists, ractopamine hydrochloride, and zilpaterol hydrochloride. This was published by the Public Library of Science, which means that all of us can read it. So first of all, let's get down to business. What are beta agonists and why are they used?
Very good, Katie. So beta agonists are analogous, so at least they have, in other words, similar properties to naturally occurring compounds that all of our bodies produce. These compounds are called catecholamine hormones when they're released in the blood, and we know them very well as adrenaline and its closely related chemicals. Now, beta agonists share some of the properties of the naturally occurring catecholamines, and they get their name because they selectively bind and agonize, or upregulate, if you will, beta receptors on cells, or beta adrenergic receptors on cells. So they have a lot of uses. In human clinical medicine, we're very familiar, all of us are very familiar with their use in human clinical medicine, in that lots of rescue inhalers for asthmatics, or daily administration of certain drugs such as Advair, include a beta agonist, and obviously they have tremendous clinical benefits. In animal production, what they found was that certain of these beta agonists, when they're fed at a certain dose, can actually increase the muscle growth, so protein accretion in muscle, if you will, which is effectively muscle growth, and they may actually decrease fat deposition a little bit. So realistically, their use in animals is to improve muscle growth in the animals.
Now, last year, I guess it was around this time, Tyson, which is one of the great industrial livestock giants, chose to stop using Zilmax, which is one of the more common of these drugs. Why did they make that decision?
So there are two beta agonists that have been approved for use in cattle by the Food and Drug Administration. Zilpaterol hydrochloride, or otherwise known as Zilmax, is one of them, mm-hmm. and ractopamine hydrochloride, otherwise known as Optiflex, is the other. Tyson suspended its purchase of animals that are fed one of them, the Zilmax product. And while I can't particularly go into the details of why they did that, certainly there has been reporting that has been done by Reuters that outlines some of the observations that have seen, and most notably, soon after arrival at the slaughter plants, some animals became profoundly lame. In fact, some of the animals lost part of their hoof wall, and that is obviously a very profound occurrence. Thankfully, it is extraordinarily rare, but nonetheless important. And while there is no definitive link to zilpaterol hydrochloride as the cause of this, clearly there was concern that it may be associated with this in some manner. So obviously Tyson took the action it did. And I believe in my interaction with them, the primary reason they took the action is that there are good people who work in Tyson who are very concerned and really want to try and promote and protect the welfare of the animals on which they rely. Mm-hmm. And so I think when we look at what happened at the packing plants, it's very hard to definitively say that zilpaterol was the cause of it. But certainly it behooves us now to better understand that relationship so that if the product is reintroduced onto the market, we can definitively say one way or the other.
Now, is this why you decided to write this paper, or was the paper that you and your colleagues published recently already in the works before Tyson chose to withdraw this drug from their supply line?
So our analysis of the feedlot data that we present in the manuscript, it was an ongoing effort over a number of years, and our manuscript was well into the drafting stage when Tyson made their decision to stop accepting cattle that were fed one of the beta agonists. Mm-hmm. And what we describe in our manuscript is separate than what are seen at the packing plants. We did not go into any packing plant data, if you will. We focus purely on some of the observations that have been seen in feedlots in cattle that are administered one of these or two of these beta agonists, not two together, but looking at them separately.
Mm-hmm. If it's not from beta agonists such as Zilmax or ractopamine, what other factors could cause things like sore feet, the muscle pain or weakness that's been described, or the reluctance to move at all? I mean, what other possible explanation could there be other than some sort of drug use?
Katie, that's a salient point. I think that is where we're needed to focus, is what are the factors that contribute to the observations that have been observed at packing plants in terms of animals that appear to be stiff or lame. Thankfully, these are rare events, but nonetheless, they are important. And if we want to control these and prevent them from happening in the future, mm-hmm. which Temple Grandin has admonished the industry that these events have to stop,
yes.
then we need to understand what are the contributing factors and whether the factors that contribute to it are whether they're related to transportation or they're related to the fact that cattle are now bigger than they used to be when we send them to slaughter. If that's a factor, how they're handled, certainly the temperature and time of the year, this seems to be overrepresented during the hottest times of the year, so summer, early summer, late summer, early fall. So there are a number of factors that we really need to explore. And there's a deal of effort going on around the country gearing up to explore those in a number of different research institutions.
Mm-hmm. And in your study in particular, which were the factors that you guys really, because you worked on the basis of observational data, as you told me earlier today. So so the observational data is what the packing plants were reporting in terms of muscle stiffness, lameness. Were there any animals that actually died from this?
So what we focused in on was what's happening at the feedlot, so before they're shipped to the slaughter facilities.
I see.
And so the data that we were able to analyze was actually collected by the feedlots and shared to us from the feedlots. So this is independent of any observation at the slaughter plant,
at the packing house, right.
And our primary interest in our analysis was trying to understand if the use of one of these drugs is associated with increased likelihood of animals dying. Mm-hmm. And we should be clear that death in feedlots, particularly during the terminal parts of feeding when these products are used, is a very rare event. And while it is rare, it is nevertheless not quite as rare in those animals that are fed beta agonist. we did see a significant increase in the likelihood of an animal dying in those groups that were administered one of these beta agonists.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Why is it that countries like Russia and China, which are hardly known for their concern over either animal welfare or human welfare, for that matter, in terms of the food chain, why has the EU as also banned the use of beta agonists in their animal production? And we have not.
I think that's another great question, Katie, and I don't know the exact answer.
Oh, come on.
except that obviously Europe has a particular societal interest and have not allowed the use of growth promotants, hormone growth promotants, or the use of beta agonist in animal production for quite a period of time. So that is an entrenched societal demand, and that is reflected in their policies. In terms of Russia and China, I don't fully know all of the factors that have contributed to their decision not to allow them, except that obviously the international body that sets the trade of food products, if you will, the Codex Alimentarius, has approved a certain maximum residue limit of ractopamine in cattle and pig products, beef and pork. And that approval process, while it has been approved, was not necessarily a consensus process. And maybe some of that non-consensus, if you will, has resulted in some of the actions of China and Russia at the moment. Hmm. But I can only speculate on that.
Mm-hmm. But there's also a discrepancy. You just mentioned the Codex Alimentarius. In the Codex, their decision about beta agonist use said the maximum residue limit could be 10 parts per billion for muscle cuts of beef and pork, whilst the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's limit is 30 parts per billion for beef and 50 parts per billion for pork. Why that discrepancy, do you think?
Well, there's a number of reasons, and I think the first and most obvious reason is that in the U.S. we only have one body, the Food and Drug Administration, that has to make the decision to set these maximum residue limits. Mm-hmm. Whereas internationally in the Codex Committee, there's well over 150 members that have to agree on some level that is deemed appropriate to facilitate trade. So I think what we're seeing in those differences is a difference of opinion of how to proceed and set maximum residue limits to encourage trade versus that to encourage domestic consumption.
Mm-hmm. Is there any danger from the residue of either of these drugs in the meat we consume?
Yeah, I don't think so, Katie. If I can just talk a little bit to the FDA drug approval process. Mm-hmm. Certainly, while it is not a perfect process, it is nonetheless a very rigorous process. And any time a drug sponsor, so a pharmaceutical company, decides to request approval of a new label, so they want to market a drug that has a certain claim associated, such as increased growth rate or control or treatment of a respiratory disease, for instance, they have to show a number of safety factors. They have to show, obviously, a target animal safety, so the drug has to be safe in the animals you use. The sponsor also has to show environmental safety, and the highest hurdle it has to get over is that it has to show human safety for those people who are going to eat the beef or pork or poultry, whatever it is, that are derived from the animals to which the drugs are administered. Mm-hmm. And that is a long and rigorous series of processes that the pharmaceutical companies have to go through. So, again, while it is not perfect, it certainly is a rigorous process. And I think that given the approval process and the rigorous nature of it, I'm fairly confident in the human safety of the approval process of these two drugs.
Mm. I'm glad to hear that, because I don't have such a rosy picture of the FDA and how they give approval. I mean, right now there are many substances that are included in our food chain, which are quote-unquote GRAS, grass generally recognized as safe, which have undergone absolutely no trials whatsoever, except for those which the industry itself chooses to put them through. For example, nanosilver in food packaging, they have no idea whether or not that crosses the blood-brain barrier, but it's being implemented, it's being used in our packaging now without any of these rigorous tests that you refer to. I wanted to... maybe I want to take a short break, actually, because it's halfway through this program. Let's take a quick, short sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Dr. Guy Lawner again, talking more about beta agonists and the food chain. I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
And I've been so satisfied. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. We're talking about beta agonists in cattle and pork production in the United States with Dr. Guy Lawner, again, a veterinary epidemiologist and professor of food safety at Texas Tech University. He is the author of a recently published paper about the impact of beta agonists such as ractopamine and Zilmax on cattle populations where cattle have been observed to possibly die from using this drug, although it's not clear. So let's talk a little bit about your study, a little more about your study, and how did the livestock industry respond to your study? Were they happy with your results?
Yeah, so as a high summary of our data, we had information on almost 1 million head of cattle across almost 20 different operations. And what we found is relatively consistently across all operations that there is a significant increase in the likelihood of death in animals that are administered a beta agonist compared to their contemporaneous controls.
Uh-huh.
This was admittedly, death is a very rare event, thankfully, in feedlots, but it is nonetheless increased, and significantly so, in those animals that were administered the beta agonist. And some of our data were from randomized controlled studies, whereas those for Zilpaterol were from observational studies, albeit in excess of 800,000 head of cattle. So a very large data set across multiple operations.
So we were talking earlier before we did the show about the value of observed data versus experimental data and pursuing this population data and drugs like beta agonists, and how the way you set up your study, or the way you wrote your study, was somewhat different from what would normally be the case, in which there would be some sort of a randomized study and then a controlled experiment on those. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between what you did for this study and what normally happens when people want to research an event such as the one you described, in which there was an increase in mortality from the use of a drug?
Sure, Katie. So in animal science, or in agricultural sciences in general, most of the training focuses on research that is conducted by experimentation. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean that, let's say we have a group of animals and we want to test how effective a drug is, we would randomize some of those animals to the drug, and then would randomize some of those animals to a placebo, for instance.
Right.
And then we would design the experiment and monitor it. And that is, those types of experiments are seen as the highest form of causal relationship. So if you want to make a statement that this drug causes that, then that type of study is seen as valuable. In human clinical medicine, however, they have come to accept a lot more observational data. So in some instances, an experiment isn't possible to do. It's either unethical, or the scope of it is difficult, or other reasons constrain your ability to do an experiment. So they're more adept at using observational data. And that's those types of tools are what we used in looking at observational data, so non-experimental data. So the concern with observational data is that you may have some problematic, extraneous variable that biases your observed relationship between, say, the drug and increased mortality. Mm-hmm. And so what we do in that situation is we collect as much information about those potential variables, such as an animal's weight or the days that they are at the feedlot before they were fed a beta agonist, or the number of health events in that pen before they were fed a beta agonist. And we test that in a statistical model to see if it actually results in a bias of our relationship. And what we found is of the variables that we were able to evaluate, none of them biased that relationship. So mm-hmm. whenever we looked at that, we saw the same thing in that use of a beta agonist was associated with a statistical increase in the likelihood of death.
Interesting. And yet the industry itself, or rather I should say the manufacturers of these drugs, which are primarily Merck and Elanco, a division of Eli Lilly, they suggested that the way you had conducted these this study was really not a valid method. So how do you respond to something like that? I mean, if they say, well, this method didn't actually work, and yet you have been able to demonstrate that in spite of all of the potential variables, you still got the same results. I mean, how do you make them sit up and listen? I guess is my question. I know it's kind of a feeble one, but still, it's sort of interesting.
Yeah, so the pharmaceutical companies, we sort of call them companies, but really each of them is made up by people. And most of them are made up by very good people, and I get to interact with them. And they try very hard to look at the data and make the right decision.
Right.
And so unusual, as I sort of tried to illustrate, in animal agriculture and agriculture in general, we rely or have relied on experimentation. So really, when you look to make decisions or make assessments of the safety of a drug or the effectiveness of a drug, you look for those experiments. And what we provided is a modeling approach that has become more common in human clinical medicine and becoming more common in veterinary medicine, but hasn't yet reached the wider agricultural industry to the same extent, mm-hmm. and that is how you explore and rigorously evaluate observational data. And so I think what we're trying to do collectively, society as a whole, is to ask some of these questions about how we make informed decision when there is no perfect data set. And I think that's what we're seeing at the moment. And I think it's worthwhile remembering that these drugs, beta agonists, add a lot of value to the beef production system. They significantly increase the amount of muscle, which turns into meat, an animal puts down, and that adds value. It also has direct benefits to the producers and the people involved in production, but also indirect benefits to society in general. And by that I mean that to produce the same amount of beef, we would use less fuel, less water, and less feed with the beta agonist than if we didn't use it, and that reduces the carbon footprint of the system. So that is a societal benefit. On the other hand, I think our data are compelling that there are concerns about animal welfare in a small subset of animals fed beta agonist. So while we have some societal benefits that are real and warrant a serious discussion about how we capture them, on the other hand, we have societal expectations of how we protect and promote the welfare of the animals we raise for food. And it's not an easy balancing act. Obviously, on one side we have value, and on the other side we have concerns about welfare.
Right, absolutely. Well, I don't think there's anything easy about any of this stuff. I mean, certainly one understands why you would want to maximize your profit margin on something that is inherently unprofitable, which is meat production. I think this is a quote from your paper about how controlled cattle experiments, the number of animals included is usually insufficient. Okay, I'm going to move on to this. As a result, most drug approvals require some post-approval monitoring. often termed the pharmacoepidemiology or type 4 trials, and the self-reporting by patients of side effects either the company, the FDA, or their doctor is part and parcel of a holistic drug regulatory framework. But in this case of the beta agonist use in livestock, that doesn't appear to have happened so much. Am I accurate in saying so? And if I am, why was that?
So the statement in our manuscript more addresses what happens in the human pharmaceutical side. In the animal pharmaceutical side, there is a specific office at the FDA that does collect information about so-called adverse drug events. And This is an office that routinely collects them. And type 4 or phase 4 studies that are performed after the drug is approved through that process of approval does happen quite a lot. But what we're saying is that most of those phase 4 studies are to evaluate the targeted label claim. So in the case of beta agonist, it's animal performance. But if you look at the magnitude of change in death loss of, say, 2 per 1,000 animals, which is a relatively small change, 0.2%, then you would require a study that would exceed 30,000 animals.
And that's
and so they become very big studies and are not the primary focus of these phase 4 studies. Mm-hmm. So what we're left with are observations that the owners and caregivers of the animals may see, and then occasionally they may raise a concern that they might be linked to a particular drug, and then they have to make the active effort to call the FDA to report those events.
Right. And that,
or they call the drug sponsor, and at that stage the drug sponsors report that, and they're very good and diligent at reporting adverse drug events.
Huh. Who knew? One of the things that really interests me about this is what you referred to earlier, which is the sort of the value, the added value of these drugs in terms of increasing the value of the animal versus concerns about animal welfare. And I'm going to read you a quote from Temple Grandin, who has been a very outspoken critic of the use of beta agonists. In fact, she was the one who got me interested in this like 3 or 4 years ago, and I've been following it ever since. So she says the following: the quality and quantity of meat are two opposing goals. Beef cattle fed too many beta agonists will have less marbling and tougher meat, and meat companies who want high-quality meat have already banned or greatly restricted these products in their programs. Unfortunately, there are some meat companies who pay a premium for animals with a high percentage of lean meat, and this has provided an economic incentive to overuse beta agonists, which have resulted in many lame cattle. She says it's quite a problem. They do this because they are selling beef to low-end consumers, and they put all the meat through a needle machine to tenderize it, and thus low-income consumers are buying most of this meat. And so the question is quality versus quantity here, and how do you balance that? And I know that's kind of sort of a philosophical question rather than a practical one, but where do you draw the line between animal welfare and profit? And how do you make that determination, especially if you're a company that is beholden to your shareholders, for example, or to a consumer population that demands cheap meat, which is what we are. Right?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and there's actually a number of questions in there, Katie. And the first one deals with how we define quality.
Yeah.
And quality in terms of beef is defined by the amount of marbling that is present in the beef. And certainly we can see that with use of certain beta agonists, either of zilpaterol or of higher doses of ractopamine, where the dose is allowed to vary, that you can decrease to some degree the amount of marbling. So that would technically be reduction in quality by the USDA definition. The other thing that Temple is talking about is that in general, when beta agonists are fed to the animals, the beef derived from those animals is not quite as tender.
Because it doesn't have the marbling, yeah.
Well, and even independent of the marbling, there is some work that would indicate that it's not quite as tender, when you have the same level of marbling.
Really?
So this difference in tenderness can be detected with very sensitive equipment. So what we call Warner-Bratzler shearforth or other types of shearforth, you can detect that. Even some trained human panels that you spend a lot of time training and getting them up to speed, they can detect a subtle difference in tenderness. But the conclusions have been that those differences are relatively subtle and most people would not detect the difference in tenderness.
Uh-huh. I thought you were going to say those very sensitive instruments called teeth, but okay.
Very good. So I think the other question you raised is this value of economics and profit versus animal welfare.
Yeah.
And I'm very glad that we're not solely driven by economics. Obviously, it's an important factor in our daily lives. We hope to make more money than we spend, or that
sure.
certainly make as much money as we need to live so we can continue on with our lifestyle. So economics is important, but obviously welfare is first and foremost a fundamental aspect of animal care. And as you raise animals for food or you are a slaughter plant, the welfare of the animals is critically important. And I think Tyson's action is really testament that welfare trumps economics. Their action led them to basically give up a lot of value, and had not other events happen, and they were the only company that did that, then they would have given up a competitive advantage or assigned to themselves a competitive disadvantage. But it's clear in that situation that welfare trumped that economic gain to be had. And again, it's not definitively linked to either one of those products, but certainly they had reasonable concern and felt they had to act to promote and protect the welfare of their animals.
Well,
so I think it's very good that welfare is so important and does trump economics.
I'd like to believe you, Guy, but I will play devil's advocate here and say, what about the fact that so many countries have banned the use of these drugs in their food sources, and thus abandoning the use of it has actually given them a competitive edge in the international market? I mean, don't you think that played as a factor in this decision as well?
Yeah, if that was a factor in their decision, I was not privy to those discussions. So the discussions I had with Tyson revolved solely around their concern about welfare of the animals.
Right.
And certainly there are trade implications. We talked previously about some countries that did not allow any level or have extremely low levels of a beta agonist in their product.
Yeah.
And they do limit trade, and trade is an important means by which value is added to beef, pork, and poultry.
Yep.
So certainly there are competing opportunities for companies as they look to how best to position themselves as a viable company in the marketplace. Do they pursue the added value of, say, using a particular drug, or do they look to gain that value or more from exports? And that's a complex issue.
Very complex. I mean, I'm thinking of the Smithfield purchase last year, you know, which spent many months being debated in Congress, but ultimately went through with the Shuanghui company in China buying Smithfield outright. And Smithfield, in advance of this sale, had already begun phasing out, for one sector of their business, hog business, had begun phasing out the use of beta agonists for that very reason, that that so many in the international market were refusing to buy from them. So I thought, you know, it, to me, it seemed like, well, you know, I'd like to think it was for the basis of animal welfare, but you know, I as you said before, this is a very complex business, and it's, I think, hard to tease out all of the motives behind decisions like this, which clearly are have a very big impact on their bottom line. Guy, I think we have to sort of wrap it up here, unfortunately, but I hope you'll come back and tell us more about animal welfare and veterinary medicine and epidemiology. If people want to read this report, and it's hard to imagine that anyone but me, as a lay person, I'm the only one who's geeky enough to actually read this. She says, snarky. But if people do want to read it, where can they find it?
So this is freely available, as you said, at PLOS One, PLOS space ONE. So it's PLOS One, and it's freely available to anyone. They just have to search for my last name. And attached to that paper is my email address. So if lay people like you or anyone wants to read it and have questions, then they can very easily just click on that hyperlink and shoot me an email, and I'm all too happy to try and answer those questions.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's really been an interesting discussion. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And I'm going to spell your last name because it's not obvious how to spell it. And it's L-O-N-E-R-A-G-A-N, correct? Lonergan.
That is correct.
Yeah, because usually it's Lonergan, I think most people think, and certainly I pronounced it fast enough so it would sound like that. So, folks, if you want to read this, and I'm sure there are other papers there with your name attached to them, Guy, about other aspects of veterinary medicine in the livestock sector, definitely worth reading. This is very readable, by the way. I mean, even though I'm a geek, you know, I'm not that smart, so it was a pleasure to read it because I could actually understand pretty much everything that it said.
Well, very good. We tried very hard to get it readable.
Yeah, no, you did a good job. It was really interesting. So thanks again for joining me today. Thanks again to my sponsor, Tabard Inn, and thanks to my engineer, Jack Inslee, as always. And we'll see you next week with another episode of What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights with me, Katie Kiefer. So long, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.